Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to Three, a part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Gil Gross with Joel Drucker and Amy Lundy. It is so good to be back. We have not gotten together since the conclusion of the Australian Open, and we're going to have all three in this show. We'll have Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal. Nadal will look at his season outlook. He pulled out of Doha. He's getting ready for this Netflix exhibition in Las Vegas. Roger Federer, it's media news. There's a documentary coming out, so we'll get to that at the end and discuss what to expect out of this upcoming Federer documentary, which is coming out sooner than later, around Wimbledon time this year. But let's start with Novak Djokovic. So I want to talk about kind of his outlook for the rest of the year, just considering what we saw at the Australian Open with the semifinal loss to Jannik Sinner. Obviously, it's been so long, we're not going to get in the weeds and dissect that semifinal at this point. But obviously, separate from everything that Sinner did well, Djokovic called it the worst performance, one of the worst performances of his career in a slam. So Amy, I want to ask you just what is the level of concern stemming from that performance as we move forward into the Sunshine Double?
I'm not concerned. He had had a brilliant tournament up until that point, and he's a human being. Everybody has a bad match. And the way that rivalries, the really great ones are built, there's some push-pull, there's some back and forth. Maybe one player figures out another player and then the other player has to respond. It's a chess move. So if you keep age out of it, which I know is really hard to do, this could be just another chapter in their rivalry.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I just think he was outplayed in that one match, but I don't know, I'm excited to see more of what's to come from Novak. He had such a great 2023, and Sinner obviously in ascent, just like Alcaraz was at Wimbledon. So now we're going to see what's to come of these young greats.
I'm not concerned because this is an outlier. Like any scientific or data-driven look at what this is going to come to the same conclusion. You can freak out about the age thing, but if you're just going to freak out about the age thing, then, well, maybe you would have freaked out after Wimbledon last year or with Nadal and Federer. We saw throughout their career, these guys hit a certain age and then they're not allowed to lose without the narrative being like, is this the start of the great decline? But in reality, yeah, he did just have an incredible 2023 season, like unbelievable. And not only that, he finished off the season incredibly strong. And now he's lost the Australian Open in the following year. That's a blip in the radar. Now, obviously, the majors are significant, but how are you going to hit like a high level of panic after the season he just had after one tournament in 2024? It's beyond me how you could get to a high level of panic, but it's the age thing that brings people there.
It wasn't even the bad tournament. It was just a bad match.
I thought he was below his level for a lot of it with the illness stuff in the beginning. Popperin had a point to go up two sets. Well, he had four set points to go up two sets to one. And then Prismic got him in a set as well. But it looked like he was rounding into form. I think coming into that semifinal, he was coming off of the round of 16 match where he smoked Adrian Mannarino. And then Fritz in the last two sets was really, really high quality, 6-2, 6-3. After Taylor had the great start. So you felt pretty good about Djokovic's level heading into the semifinal, but then, you know, he threw in a clunker, right? It happens every 4 or 5 years.
No, he got outplayed. He just got outplayed by a guy. And again, I think the tricky thing with a young player like a Sinner, as we saw with Alcaraz, you don't know what the ceiling is. So it's playing against someone like that. Is he dangerous? Is he good? Is he erratic? What's going on out here? You don't quite know what his thing is, because Sinner's improvement is going like this over the last year. And so we don't know what that means. I remember, I'm going to go back many, many years when the young Pete Sampras played Ivan Lendl in the quarterfinals of the US Open. And so like the grand blossoming of Pete Sampras suddenly. And now all this stuff that's been talked about, sort of like a Sinner or a different playing style, but all coming together right here in front of us. And that's what Sinner did over those last two rounds in Australia this year.
Well, that's actually another aspect to it, is the head-to-head, right? Sinner has now won three out of their last four. It's rare that ever happens to Novak Djokovic since 2011. That I don't know that anybody's won three out of four on a stretch. But I think that has also gotten people thinking, like, is Jannik a massive roadblock now? Is there a head-to-head issue? Amy, like, do you see anything in that matchup other than Sinner? I mean, Sinner's just played incredible tennis in the last 6 months, and he's improved as a player, not just against Novak, but against everybody. What do you make of the current state of the Djokovic versus Sinner head-to-head?
I think Sinner has learned a lot by playing Djokovic and by watching him. His serve is much improved, and his net game is much improved, and getting to the point where it's on par with Novak's. So, you know, I think some of it will come down to scouting tendencies, you know, situationally, where will Novak serve on 40-15, you know, that kind of thing. But I do think that confidence is, as much as I like to talk about specifics of the matchup, I do think confidence is a thing, because as Novak gets older, the age thing is going to be in the back of his mind. But if there's anybody who can overcome that because of his mental strength and acuity, I think it's Novak, and he'll just have to meditate on this. And, you know, within the rivalry, I think he'll have multiple opportunities to regain his confidence.
Now, I would call Sinner, I heard you use the word massive. I would say currently significant, it's not roadblock, significant rival. I mean, he's beaten him three of the last four times, including most recently. He also beat him in some significant events too. He beat him at Davis Cup, and he beat him at a major. So this wasn't a lower tier event. But I won't upgrade him. I won't upgrade him to massive until he beats Novak in a second major. That's the way I look. Then it's not a roadblock as much as like, wait a second, here he is. And just like the way Novak, I don't think he views Alcaraz as a massive roadblock or something. He views him as a guy who beat me that time at Wimbledon, who I beat two more times in 2023, including an incredible, one of the great 2-3 set matches you'll ever see was that Cincinnati final.
I do think that Sinner has reached the point of well-roundedness that makes it difficult for Djokovic to really pick on any one part of the game. And like he'll snuff that out, right, against everybody. Novak is able to execute basically whatever tactic there that exists in this sport. And if he's playing Medvedev and he needs to serve and volley, great. If he's playing Tsitsipas and he needs to figure out ways to get him running into that backhand, cool. If he's playing Rude and he needs to come forward and make Casper hit backhand passing shots, great. I do think Sinner has, at the very least, even Alcaraz, I want to throw in here in that list. If we want to be more consistent and outserve him and rush the forehand as much as possible, cool. You don't really know what to do against Sinner right now. Similar to, you don't really know what to do against Djokovic. And that's why he's had so much success. But now that Jannik's forehand is consistent and he serves well and he's physical and he moves well, it's tough to... You almost have to go out there and just be like, I got to outplay him, but there's no like great way to beat him.
No, he's really good. And he's got a kind of narrow, but he's broadened and he's improved things. And we've all seen the work he's put into things like his serve and learning to move forward better. And obviously the influence of his coaches, including Darren Cahill, and he's just getting comfortable. You've just seen, I mean, the, the ascent to a semi and to winning one. So that's what's going to be. It's going to be fun to watch Sinner through the next 6 months, right? To see where things go for him all the way, probably through till, well, for the year.
100%. He is 32-2 since the U.S. Open. Four titles in seven events. One of them was a withdrawal, which is why he has he's lost three events, but he only has two losses on his record. And he's up to number three in the world now. So hopefully we see him play once in the Sunshine Double. My hunch is that we will see that once, either at Indian Wells or Miami. Let's see. Let us go on now to Rafa Nadal.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
After Brisbane, he had the micro tear, said it wasn't severe, said it wasn't bad news for the season, no reason to panic, but I can't play the Australian Open. A couple weeks later, we find out Doha's on the schedule. We're going to play Doha. Prior to Doha, it's another withdrawal announcement, this time with not a lot of medical detail, which Rafa had been providing, but this time he just says, quote, "I am not ready to compete," and we don't get that detail. I gotta say, like, when it's reached the point of setbacks, withdrawals, can't play this, can't play that, where my confidence in Nadal's body holding up, it's gone down, and I'm talking for 2024, it's gone down quite a bit now, Joel, and I'm worried that Rafa's not going to be able to play as much tennis this year as he wants to.
I agree with you. I wrote this in January, particularly when he pulled out of Australia and he said he was going to be in Doha and that didn't happen. It's kind of like, okay, minute to minute. It's almost like we got to enjoy him. It's like the way he plays, one point at a time, and just see how it can be. And each match, not that every match is going to be his last match. I don't know how that, I mean, I don't know these. It's so different how you can navigate your career in an individual sport. I mean, he could come back in 2026 for all we know, right? Whatever. But I know it's really frustrating for everyone who so loves watching Nadal play and seeing quite what's going on in that body and a lot, so much of this wear and tear and training and practice. I do think, though, I knew he was going to play a hardcore tournament before the clay. I didn't think he was ever going to, just because he wants to point towards the French doesn't mean he was going to just jettison parts of the Sunshine Double, and Indian Wells is the one he likes most. And there we have it. So hopefully, and we'll see, we've got this exhibition in Las Vegas on Sunday. So hopefully that'll come off.
It's ironic that Alcaraz is the one that's really questionable for it, apparently. There's a pretty good piece in The Athletic, and it was, the gist of it was sort of like, Nadal is doing what now? He's coming to the United States, he's going to play an exhibition in Indian Wells? Really? Of course, just like you said, Joel, he probably wasn't going to leave that on the table, and he's been out on the golf course with Larry Ellison or friends playing 18 holes of golf a day. So he can't be feeling that bad. He is set to play this exhibition. And, we know that Nadal just likes to compete. So if he is fit and healthy, he'll do it. And if he's not, then he won't.
And Las Vegas is quite close to Indian Wells. So yeah, that's fine. I suspect it will not be a commercial flight.
These guys are getting paid for this is undisclosed, but you got to imagine that it's pretty good.
Netflix money is endless. There's a media story there that would be the kind of thing that we wouldn't discuss on this podcast, but we discuss off air. But just quickly getting back to Nadal, like I do also think there's this weird dynamic because the concern is about his body, his ability to just get out on court healthy and play. But if he is playing, again, you go back to Brisbane, the level was impressive. I still think that as long as he's playing, he's going to be doing quite a fair bit of winning. It's just a matter of, can he get out there? But don't you also kind of think about this feedback loop where if he's playing, he's winning. And then if he's winning, he's playing more. And if he's playing more, then he's more likely to just get injured again.
That's a potential feedback loop that's part of the Nadal. You know, we've been seeing this for almost 20 years, right? Since the foot injury, he was a teenager, right? And that's why he's the Sisyphus of tennis, up and down. And this, right. And now more than ever, because of the stage he's at in his life and his body and all the miles, right?
Yeah. And if I could jump in, because that was a weird pretzel-y statement that I just made. I'm talking about that in regards to Nadal finishing off his career the way he wants to, right? Like on his own, right? Out on court. And Joel, I know you have thoughts on this, but it's almost as if it's really even harder to find that proper ending, because winning gives you hope to play on, but playing on increases the likelihood that it actually ends up being injury that ends your career, and not okay, I'm good. This is it now. I'm ending by playing a match.
There are no terms. There are no your terms. There are no their terms. There's no as you want it. We all live on our terms. We all don't live on our terms. I mean, I don't want to sound like some motivational Yoda, whatever the hell, but I just think the whole that is a, I would call that a consumer imposed desire to see such ending. Like we've all seen our share of movies, TV shows, and occasionally in sports, those moments, because they mostly don't happen that way in sports, as they never happen in life. So
I think, sorry to jump in. I think, Gil, that you are assuming that is the end goal, to end on his terms. Maybe he doesn't care how it ends, you know, maybe it just ends how it ends. And
he said he doesn't want to end his career in a press conference.
Well, he doesn't have to end it in a press conference, but isn't he the type of guy that there's a match in front of him? His goal is to win that match. Is the ultimate goal to end on my terms?
Okay, I guess no, but I guess what I'm saying is he's not going to do a Venus Williams, for example, or I don't know if Venus is even a good example because she continues
Andy
to
Murray.
Play because she likes it. I guess a Murray. My point is, like, let me think of a better example. Like, this happened a little bit to Isner. Some players, what I'm saying is some players are told that it's the end because they can no longer win. And I actually don't think, I think Nadal is too skilled for that to happen. I think he's either in a state of having quite a bit of success winning, or he's injured. And I think those are the only two modes. I don't think he's playing, but he can't win. And by the way, Federer was the same, because as much as we like to go, oh, Roger, he lost 6-0 to Hurkacz in the quarters on one knee. And yeah, he was on one knee. It's like, hello, he was in the quarters. And then at Roland Garros, he won three matches a couple weeks back. And then if you go back before then, he was in the Australian Open semifinal when he had his previous injury. Roger never got to a place where he wasn't winning tennis matches. It never happened. It just got to a place where his body said no.
Okay. Well, yeah. So it's a mix of body and results. And I just think that, I mean, you're right. I definitely do have a point. I think that whole term, on your terms, I don't think you play on your, I guess technically we all do and we all don't. What does that mean, your terms? Really? I mean, I just hear it like, you know?
I know. Everybody says it. And what does it mean?
I just think.
Crap
term, and I hope I never use it in writing ever. But I do, you're being on me.
Okay. Got it. But let me put it more literally then. I just think Rafa would like it at the end of his career to be deciding that it's his last tournament and then playing a tennis match, not I'm injured again. Okay, that's it.
You know, all right, so he may. But I mean, he would decide beforehand, this will be my last tournament. And when I exit this tournament on my feet, I can then say, you know, I don't know. And I think for all of them, problem, it's so personal. You know, I noticed there's always a lot of dialogue about the Pete Sampras thing. But recall, Pete Sampras did not play that match and retire that minute. He didn't say this is months later. I think it happens in all their different ways for all of them, their body, their psyche, their family, their desires to spend time with other people, who even their boredom of travel, all sorts of things.
Yeah, well, if Laver Cup didn't exist, then what would it have looked like for Federer? But the point is, everybody wants to have Pete is different. I mean, Pete's one
everybody,
of a kind,
wait,
right?
Everybody, by everybody, no, you mean every player? Everybody, no, you mean every fan?
Not everybody. Well, first, every fan, yes. 90% of players want some sort of fanfare where they can have a moment, I think, to accept the end in a positive way, where they can feel good about. That's why Roger went to play, you know, the Laver Cup thing was great, but he did the Laver Cup thing for a reason. He didn't just say, okay, that's it.
But the decision about that, that's attitudinal, not circumstantial. You can make your attitude, you can apply your attitude to any circumstance. You could break your leg running down a drop shot, be carted off and say, so be it. I left blood out there and I'm being carted off the court and my career has ended. Or you can say, I just lost to Brian Gottfried. Played his last slam match versus his longtime buddy Jimmy Connors, and he lost and he jumped the net over, and Connors said, what are you doing? Why are you jumping the net? I just beat you. It's my last slam match. And it's like, we can all, it's the attitude, not the circumstances.
I think I'm a little with Joel on this. I think the Laver Cup thing is a bad example because Roger Federer wasn't really a doubles player. And he just, that was more of a ceremony than it was an actual match or way to go out. You know, that was just a chance to give fans and a good video and a good goodbye and a good memories and stuff like that. But it wasn't really how his career ended. You know what I mean? Because it was a doubles match with Rafa. Where it ended was that last singles match at Wimbledon. And that was really the end of his career.
Well, okay, fair enough. But I'm actually saying, one of my points is also that Rafa is going to be similar to that, the way things are trending, where it's either winning or injuries. But anyway, I think we've exhausted it.
We've drifted far afield.
I like the federologist. Yeah, what would the federologist think of how Federer? The question, just one last question on this, and we can then say,
sure,
what better. How did Roger Federer truly end his career at Wimbledon or at Laver Cup? I think it's kind of fun to think about. I like that. I like that way you described it, Amy. It's kind of like a ceremonial coda. Mm-hmm.
It was, but it was very nice. We're all glad it happened, right?
Oh, I love
it. Oh, yeah. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It certainly went out on my terms.
I am glad that the Netflix exhibition is happening. Knock on wood, fingers crossed that it actually does happen, because I feel like it's important, or it's going to be really nice. It's going to be really nice to see Nadal and Alcaraz share the court. There's a passing of the torch. I mean, we are not, you know, we're not in Spain. We don't have that like Spanish tennis mindset, but I do think there's a significance there of some sort of like, let's make sure that this happens, that we have Nadal and Alcaraz share a tennis court together before Rafa says goodbye. And I think that's going to be really nice. So much so that I am going. And I'd like to, I didn't say that off air, announcing this on the show.
Oh, I see. That's why you're so glad to be going to it. Right. Well, as opposed to a pre-Indian Wells Sunday afternoon practice session, you're going to see an exhibition. And see
great.
That's fantastic.
You'll be able to give us a report. And, you know, if Alcaraz can't go, how about Novak? Get him in there. Why not? They're taking planes together and posting about it on social media. So why not?
No. I thought you were about to say if Alcaraz can't and you want people to have the whole Spanish approach, understand the grinding and the hard work of Spain, why, if Alcaraz can make it, why not Gil? Rafa, Gil, you like lefties. You're good.
I'll bring my rackets. No,
bring your rackets. Yeah, make sure string them a little tighter for Las Vegas.
Good advice.
Stay hydrated.
Yeah.
Have fun.
I might need the extra tension for the pace coming in as well.
Yeah, maybe. And the topspin. Yeah, good.
I have no idea what to expect. It's uncharted territory. It's being put on by Netflix. It's at Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas. Haven't been to Vegas since I was like 10 years old. It's a pretty different experience being in Vegas when you're 10 versus when you're in your mid-20s. So there's that. There's a bit of an undercard. Fritz Tiafoe, Sam Querrey, John Isner, they're all going to be there. I think one of the Bryan Bros, if not both,
I think Bob.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I'm kind of going into it pretty blind. I'm going basically through Monday match analysis, and I'm going to experience it and to report back, and to talk about it on the podcast. We'll see if I, you know, get any interview content done or any kind of cool footage, but really it's going over there to experience it. What should be a pretty special and unique event, and just seeing what happens from there.
Enjoy. We'll want to know all about it.
See if you can get a question in to Rafa if you get media availability.
You know, I don't know if, and I know this sounds crazy, I'm not sure they're going to be made available.
Yeah, I think there might be one phenomena. We could talk. We'll talk about it offline.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not positive about that. I think Netflix might, obviously they're going to talk to the players in some capacity. I just wonder if there's going to be some on broadcast Netflix exclusivity there, and us credentialed media are not going to be able to chat with them. We'll see what happens. Speaking of entertainment, Federer documentary. The only thing I don't have written down in my notes is what platform it's being
Amazon.
Released on. Okay, Amazon.
Amazon.
Thank you. So this doc is going to focus on the last 12 days leading up to Laver Cup. Roger had the idea to start the doc. He went to his good friend and very big tennis fan, Anna Wintour, and Anna Wintour hooked him up with the necessary connections to make this happen. So it was literally Roger's idea. It is supposed to be released around Wimbledon. And one other note I want to leave you with, Amy. Mirka Federer gave her first interview in over a decade for the making of this documentary. How excited are you for this?
Yeah. I mean, it's a trend in documentaries right now where the athlete is backing the documentary. So from a purist standpoint, this will have Roger's stamp of approval, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be some absolutely golden footage in there and emotional moments. And I can't wait to see it.
I agree.
I don't think it's going to win an Oscar, but it should be really good for Federer fans.
Definitely not neutral about it. Yeah, I definitely am excited to see it. And it's, just to see Roger, I mean, yeah, these things, well, a lot of this created, so I guess it's Roger's last dance. It's like sort of, he's the guy, you know, he wanted to make it happen. And it's obviously going to be a lot of the things he wants to show in it, but it's fun. I mean, it's something, and I saw recently this tweet of Roger hitting on a backboard. Just Roger himself commands curiosity. What's he saying? What's he thinking? How's he feeling? How do people react to him? That's interesting too, how they connect with him. He's sort of this He's like the James Bond Beatles of tennis.
Yeah, it's kind of like a last dance, but it's also kind of not, because it's so focused, right? It's not, which I'm really happy about, because there has been, and Amy, you alluded to the kind of player directed doc that ends up being almost like just, it becomes a nostalgia booster, but you don't mm-hmm. learn anything.
Right.
And there's not a lot of honesty in a lot of these pieces. It's like, it's almost like you could have gone on YouTube and just looked up the highlights and gotten like a similar rush of nostalgia and dopamine. But what I really like about this is it actually has like a focus. It's the 12 days leading up to this massive Laver Cup goodbye. And I think what we're going to end up seeing a lot of is how the tennis community and Roger, basically how Roger does the rounds and says goodbye and says thank you to everybody in the tennis community and vice versa. Because I imagine that's what the 12 days leading up to that were mostly about.
That's a great production question, because in a way, you could, if you organize that story, you could do it as literally the occurrences over those 12 days, or you could do what I call kind of the micro history. We do those 12 days, but you beam in the flashbacks, the cutaways to other moments. So if you're shaking hands, you're saying goodbye to, and you bump into Mark Philippoussis, do you juxtapose the image of him playing Mark Philippoussis in the 03 Wimbledon final? You know what I mean? I read this great book once on John Kennedy's inaugural address, and in the course of it, they touched on his whole life because they used that as a launching pad. So it'd be interesting. I'm fascinated to see how that does. One thing this does, though, is show you Roger's, no, see, this is how I ended my career. Sorry, you guys. No, my career did not end when I lost at Wimbledon 6-0 in the fourth set. My career ended when I had these 12 days and then this grand thing at Laver Cup. So it is this kind of like and I don't blame the athletes. If I was an athlete, I'd want to do it too. Self-created narrative construction. Winston Churchill said once, history will be kind to me, for I shall write it.
Yeah.
That's what these athlete things are.
That would be, if you took, you know, if you took these 12 days and then you used it to flashback to tell the story of his entire career, that would be more the last dance mold or formula.
Some of the moments of his career, not the entire career, but some.
Yeah.
Certain notable things like, yeah.
It's different than Last Dance, though, because Last Dance was not purely Michael Jordan's vehicle. There were other producers and players that kind of approached Jordan and said, would you do this? Would you sit for an interview? And so he was but one piece of the puzzle. This is something that was Federer's idea, and he backed it, and he took it to Anna Wintour, his friend, and said, I'm the executive producer of this, and I'm going to see this through. So he'll have final cut on everything. But it for nostalgia buffs, and you know there's going to be some tears, it's going to be really cool to see it.
Well, also, yeah. Wasn't Last Dance, they didn't know how that season was going to end when they shot, when they last danced the Michael Jordan, they were shooting a season, right?
Yes. Well, right. That final season, they offered unprecedented camera access to the Bulls season, which, by the way, Federer has, it also came out in the public information about this documentary. He let the camera crews in his house. He let the camera crews in his hotel. So, you know, that was kind of, I think, part of, I don't know how hands-on Roger will really feel or really felt the need to be in terms of like, I want to talk about this and I want the documentary to cover that. I think it was really about like, hey, like, let's make sure we just get all of this that's happening in these 12 days.
I want to go back to Last Dance. The last 12 days before I finished my career playing an exhibition playing doubles. A different thing than Last Dance, where it's like you're in for a season and we don't know how this season is gonna.
Yes.
Yeah.
And had Jordan even announced that was going to be his last season, or did he only pull the cord? He didn't, because
only pulled the cord. Yeah. So it's, and then so many years have passed since then. You know, we now have the retrospective or the hindsight to realize that was the last dance now. And that, you know, with Federer, it was all predetermined. Like,
for this the Bulls. My last dance. Well, wait. For the Bulls, it was the last dance.
Well, that's true. They knew that at the time.
They did know that at the time, but it's a different thing, I think, when you permit a cinema verite season-long access to a sports team in flux that's competing in real games than a single sport athlete saying, this is my dance 12 days prior to the event that I own.
But Gil, to your point about, you know, Roger just let the cameras in and then he just kind of lived his life. That's true. But as we three know, it's really about the edit and like who has final say over the edit. And, you know, if I were had final cut over something about my life, I would only want to show certain parts and maybe not other parts. And it's just something for viewers to keep in mind.
No, totally agree. I would just say, like, if Federer were doing the 2011 US Open semifinal against Novak and that were the documentary, he might have a little bit more to say about how that's portrayed, the events of that and how it's portrayed versus this, which it's like, okay, like it's not like, you know, basically it's not going to be an example where like with Michael Jordan's gambling, for example, where it's something that could easily be portrayed as like a very negative thing or as like something that is maybe less negative or portrayed more positively. But yeah, it's definitely the buck will stop with Roger. It is a good thing to keep in mind. I agree. All right. Well, lots to look forward to in that case. Again, that documentary, they haven't set a date, but it's going to come out around Wimbledon time. I'm sure we'll talk about it at that point. Indian Wells draw will be coming up next week, and we will talk to you then. That'll do it for this episode of 3. Remember, we're available on all podcast platforms. And if you're watching on YouTube, like, comment, and subscribe. We will see you next time on the next episode of 3.